This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
River in the sky, flowing by. River in the sky, all around the world. Sudden rainfall comes, it's a gusher. This never happened in my daddy's day. Nobody alive seen it like this. It's a gusher.
The atmospheric river that drenched British Columbia with record-breaking amounts of rain has also taken lives.
When rivers in the sky fall all at once, another atmospheric river just blasted the Pacific Northwest. Vancouver, Canada was hit by flooding in multiple suburbs, an emergency evacuation in nearby Deep Cove. For a city very used to rain, this was a crazy, record-fast downpour that washed away homes and killed at least two people. The surprise super-flooding in Appalachia with Hurricane Helene was possible because an atmospheric river accompanied that hurricane. That is a known connection. Another is La Niña, and we investigate all this in this program. Less known, atmospheric rivers are moving toward the poles, invading both the Arctic and Antarctica. That changes the ice world, and that changes everything. Later in the show, we talk with author and acknowledged expert Dr. Qinghua Ding. But first, let's spend a quick 14 minutes with the grand old man of coastal science, North Carolina scientist Dr. Orrin Pilkey. We talk about Appalachia and the safe haven that wasn't, and the danger we're all in.
This never happened in my daddy's day. Nobody alive seen it this way. It's a gusher.
There is a new book full of climate threats, of course, but also some new ideas to help you cope, not just governments, but you. It is called Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. The main author is Dr. Orrin H. Pilkey, Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. Dr. Pilkey founded much of what we know about coastal science. From North Carolina, Orrin Pilkey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm happy to be here.
Yes, we last talked in 2019 about the need to start withdrawing from the coastline. You gave us the old saying, if you can see the sea can see you. But now we see some awful death and damage in Appalachia. It seems like storms from the hot ocean can find places way up in the mountains. I did not expect this. Did you?
No, I definitely didn't expect it. In fact, I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that we had ranked as the mountains of North Carolina be the best place to move, the safest place to move, as the atmosphere gets hotter, which it's rapidly doing. And so that was our number one place, our number one haven, climate haven. And it turns out it got damaged. We based the statement of the classification on the heat problem. The heat in the mountains with elevation will not get oppressive as it will here in the coastal plain in Piedmont of southeastern U.S.
Do you have any stories of Hurricane Helene from your stomping grounds in the Carolinas?
We've had them in the past. Yes, of course. I'm in the Piedmont, which is quite a ways away from the ocean, but nothing of in the immediate past, nothing of the magnitude that we've seen here. My parents, who retired in Mississippi in 1959, got their house was basically destroyed by hurricanes, two of them, Hurricane Camille and at first, and then Hurricane Katrina later. They had 6 feet of water in the house in Camille, and they successfully escaped from it. But when Hurricane Katrina came with a 30-foot storm surge, the house was destroyed completely. However, they had moved by that time. They had moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, luckily.
So we do get news reports about the homes and lives wrecked, but nothing about hurricane damage to nature. With your specialty, can hurricanes damage coasts? I mean, do they speed up coastal erosion, for example?
Hurricane damage is so widespread, it often isn't even recognized, considering the fact that the sea level is rising because of climate change and the fact that the hurricanes will be more powerful because the oceans are warmer. And they'll have more rain because the oceans are warmer, and so on and so on. It goes. We're in for a future of pretty significant increase in hurricanes, both in frequency and especially in power. So it's a very serious thing for those folks who live close to the ocean.
And I read in the book, too, speaking of big winds, that there was also evidence that increasing greenhouse gases will change the behavior of tornadoes in the U.S.
It's a little less clear, I think, the impact on tornadoes, but it's no question it is going to increase the number of tornadoes. And some of the tornadoes will be associated, of course, with hurricanes.
Your book also covers climate and health, a lot about heat, of course, but there was one odd thing that caught my eye. Most medical experts do not expect human breathing problems until carbon dioxide reaches at least 1,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. And in 2024, we topped out around half of that, 426 parts per million. So do you recall why your team says increasing CO2 might even affect our cognitive abilities when it builds up indoors? I read in your book that if there's more CO2 outdoors as it goes up, there may be more CO2 build up indoors, and that's when it could affect our cognitive abilities.
Yes, that has been, shall I say, demonstrated fairly well, and it is something that we really have to be aware of that possibility. The solution to that, of course, is to get rid of the CO2 source, whatever that is, in your house. But it's a significant possibility. I don't think it's a major thing right now, but I think it has a chance, like so much else with climate change, a chance of getting worse in the future.
Well, the things that are happening right now is extreme heat. Just recently, Phoenix, the state of Nevada, parts of Texas set all-time October temperature records. One of my hometowns of Toronto, Ontario, was 78 degrees today, pretty warm down through the southeast again in late October for Halloween. Oren Pilkey, how would you describe the future of heat? What's coming?
Well, that's a major part of climate change. We anticipate that in North America that the heat, maybe in the central part of the continent, it will continue to increase as long as we don't do something about the emissions that we're providing the atmosphere. The heat is going to get worse. And it's going to get to the point where some parts of North America will be unlivable. And that goes for parts of North Carolina where I'm living right now. And the suggestion of climatologists is that in order to avoid this extreme heat, we have to go north or we have to go up. Either one would avoid the extreme heat. That's why we had recommended the mountains of North Carolina as a good place to move before the hurricane came. The recommendation is we should move 45 degrees north or higher for the ideal situation, that for a much better situation than we have here. And that the 45 degree north line is approximately a line from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine. Ideally, to avoid what's coming if we don't do something about emissions. That's the line to move to. As long as you've got an air-conditioned home, of course, you can exist anywhere, but that eventually you're going to work outside. Eventually, the power is going to go out and so forth. So this is a very serious possibility, probability that's going to happen with climate change.
You know, most ecologists say we have to go back to nature, or at least emulate her sustainable ways. Why does your book title suggest escaping nature?
Because nature is being impacted so heavily by climate change. I mean, climate change is part of nature, and we don't escape nature always, everywhere, everything, but we have to treat nature, look at it so different now because of the climate changes. We can't make the same assumptions we've always been making about weather and danger of flooding and so forth. Predictability is different now, and it's going to get more different than in the past. Basically, what we mean by escaping nature is we're not going to leave nature, but nature's going to be different. We have to recognize that.
Yes, it seems like in warming weather we have the tropical West Nile virus popping up in New England. Your book suggests Burmese pythons may spread across the American South. It sounds like a whole new landscape of critters is coming with climate change, and not all of them are friendly. What do you see coming as far as the wildlife in their changes with climate change?
Well, climate change will have positive impact on some animals and negative impact on others, obviously. The python, that figure that we have in the book, is based basically on temperature, and but of course some of the marshes and swamps further north will still be suitable for the python, presumably. But that may be a little bit of a longer study. I'm not sure we worry about the python, but there's a lot of other things that we could be worrying about. I think the way I look at it, Lisa, is that we have to escape some of the changes that are being made.
It's strange because we have escaped nature by our own actions, by changing the atmosphere and all the things that come from that. And yet we also have to escape this new and very dangerous nature, for us at least, as humans, yeah. as we go along. And yet you and your team are not counting on government action. In fact, you say for now people have to, quote, fend for themselves. Why don't you join the throng of experts who just map out big plans for big governments? This book seems to go more direct to the readers.
What we're doing to change the amount of CO2 and so forth, the emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere, we have just scratched the surface. You know, we have a lot of solar panels, we got a lot of windmills, but yet the temperature's going up. The CO2, the emissions are continue to increase, almost unaffected by what we're doing. Maybe we can look at something like our space program, where we put so much into getting to the moon and getting to Mars and so forth, spending billions of dollars. And there's a great deal of support for that program. But here, when we're going and looking at space, we're looking at a new situation in Kari, but here, back home, we're already in trouble. We're already in serious trouble. The best statement I've heard regarding it, I think, is by the UN Secretary Antonio Guterres. Says, this isn't quite the way he said. We're heading toward a climate disaster with our foot still on the accelerator. Such an important viewpoint. We really are still increasing the problem. We have not gotten into the gist of this problem yet. we haven't made the effort that we need, that we haven't put in the money that we need to really make a change.
The new book is Escaping Nature, How to Survive Global Climate Change. It's a big book, and we didn't even get to the fascinating photos. I spent a lot of time looking at photos in this book, and there's a long list of helpful resources in print and that you can find online. The major author and team leader is Dr. Oren Pilkey. He's the Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. Oren, thank you for this book, and thanks for spending time again with our listeners.
This is my pleasure, and I hope we've made some impact, some understanding that the problem is with us and it's getting worse, and we still have our foot on the accelerator. I'm 90 as of 3 days ago.
I'm heading towards 80. I'm not there yet. You just celebrated your 90th. We're probably not going to live till 2040 or 2060 to see whether these climate predictions come true. Why are we still doing this so passionately, Oren?
That's a very good question. I like to think it's because we have children and grandchildren, and I even have a great-granddaughter. And I know that I'm concerned for their future. I feel that with my age, I have enough experience and viewpoint that's got a lot of information behind it that I can do this well, and I should take advantage of it. But I'm not doing it anymore because I'll get an advance in rank or get more money. That's a different matter now. I'm no longer into that game.
Well, I'm not doing it for the money either. I give the whole show away for free all over the world. So I'm glad we're still on the same page. Thanks a lot for talking with me. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Can I just say other things are going on in the world beside the American election? Important things. The United Nations Environment Program just warned this world is currently heading towards more than 3 degrees centigrade global warming. Only immediate slashing greenhouse gas emissions this year could keep us below even 3 degrees. You know 3 degrees is beyond catastrophe for this civilization and most species, like mammals and eventually a lot of sea life. It is not dangerous. It is final. That sounds important. Also, there are 3 major international conferences this and next month where the world tries to grapple with disappearing species, climate change, and expanding deserts. Only one nation in the world was not part of the UN Biodiversity Conference, called COP16. The United States has never ratified the One World Treaty to protect the last of wildlife and living systems.
The time of words is over. We know what the problem is. There have been lots of conferences about it, lots of meetings, lots of declarations, but now what we need is action.
These conferences will not stop the fossil fuel titans or our addicted populations from accelerating climate change. Perhaps they can shape a vision of how we can do better, but is that enough? I look forward to that debate on major networks instead of the endless soap opera of American elections. By the way, other countries hold elections, and they do it from announcement to final results in just weeks. In ancient Byzantium, we're talking the years 800 or 900 of our common era, it was first known as New Rome. The citizens were divided into 2 competitive teams, the Blues and the Greens. These teams, if you call them that, were part politics, part sports, and part ranting and violence. History repeats in country after country these days. We just had an election in our neck of the woods where, more than 1 week later, I still don't know who will be our next government. The vote was almost exactly divided between polar extremes on the left and the right. Europe is going through similar things, and America, well, that's the famous example. Dictatorship waits in the wings. This may be intentional, driven by other nations or gangs wanting to weaken their opponents, or it may be just a stage of civilization in decline. Either way, while we battle each other, the natural ground we stand on, the water we drink, the temperature, survival, everything is changing under our feet. Pay attention to the news from the real world, the planet that can live without us. As you heard, one of those alerts from the natural world is freak extreme rainfall events all over the world. Every day we see new videos of a city somewhere in the world submerged by raging floodwaters. Not all of these are associated with atmospheric rivers. Other kinds of fronts and storms can bring fast rain floods. But many historic, mind-boggling, extreme rains, like a foot, 2 or 3 feet, up to a meter in 24 hours, arrive with atmospheric rivers that can last for days. Here is how Wikipedia describes atmospheric river. The term was originally coined by researchers Reginald Newald and Yong Zhu of Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the early 1990s. It was to reflect the narrowness of the moisture plumes involved. Atmospheric rivers are typically several thousand kilometers long and only a few hundred kilometers wide. And a single one can carry a greater flux of water than Earth's largest river, the Amazon River. There are typically 3 to 5 of these narrow plumes present within a hemisphere at any given time. These have been increasing in intensity slightly over the past century. End quote from Wikipedia. According to one source, the American Meteorological Society started using the term atmospheric river in 2017. Television weather reporters only recently started reporting them, although so-called Pineapple Express was used to describe wet storms hitting California in the past. Unless you are in college now, you never learned about them in school. The whole large-scale damaging phenomenon is still a new frontier in atmospheric science, but a brutal reality already in many countries. Not everywhere is vulnerable. The interior of continents and very dry places are generally exempt from atmospheric rivers. ARs do strike anywhere hurricanes can form, but also in places that seldom see tropical storms. For example, Vancouver, Canada, the recent target of the Sky River downfall, only experienced one tropical cyclone in records, or hurricane, since the records began, and that was Typhoon Frida in 1962. Atmospheric rivers have been reported in the United States, of course, and Canada, New Zealand, the UK, Portugal and Spain, Southeast Asia like the Philippines and Indonesia, and the coast of Chile. They also hit Antarctica and the Arctic. More about that to come. Atmospheric rivers can be beneficial, providing up to half the water California requires, including for its famous agriculture. Some cause major landscape damages, though, including landslides, broken highways, and countless flooded homes and farms. Strangely, the most deadly atmospheric rivers on record happened in California in 1862, and then in British Columbia, Canada, in November 2021 and this October 2024.
Let's go to the pole when it gets too hot down here. Let's go to the pole and see what is going on.
But look beyond our narrow world. These sky rivers are pushing big changes at both poles. In March 2022, East Antarctica experienced an intense heat wave, driven by the most powerful atmospheric river ever recorded over the region. Temperatures soared up to 40 degrees C, that's 104 Fahrenheit, above normal. The heat wave affected an area the size of India and led to significant ice melt. But our guest, expert King Hua Ding, cautions, we do not know if that one was caused by climate change, partly because our records at the South Pole are so short. We might be missing some established long-term cycle. But his science can show atmospheric rivers are going toward the poles more often. Up to a third of all rainfall reaching the Arctic in a year is delivered in just a few days during the arrival of atmospheric rivers. I find that amazing. Polar rainfall can speed glacial reduction and certainly pushes a decline in sea ice. We know declining sea ice reflects less solar energy, adding to more warming, which increases the moisture capacity of the atmosphere, leading to more and more powerful atmospheric rivers. That feedback is already in motion. Let me tell you about two more important connections. The development of atmospheric rivers is linked to the state of the ocean cycle called ENSO, known to the public as either La Niña or El Niño. We just came out of a single El Niño year, which discourages the formation of atmospheric rivers. The arrival of another major AR on the Pacific North Coast is another sign of this La Niña year being born. ENSO is a natural cycle in the eastern Pacific Ocean. Very New Science, released October 24th in the Proceedings of the National Academy, finds this oscillation of La Niña and El Niño has been going on for at least 250 million years. In previous ages, the two states hit extremes we have not seen. Whether that will be tripped by global warming and start again, we do not know. We also know that climate change may alter the patterns of La Niña and El Niño. I have seen different results and predictions. The essential point for now, the ENSO state is a major factor determining when atmospheric rivers can form. The second connection, atmospheric rivers may accompany tropical cyclones or not. Each can form separately, but there is solid science showing they are fellow travelers. An atmospheric river accompanied Hurricane Helene and is likely the cause of the flooding that struck the former climate haven of North Carolina and nearby states. Several days of heavy rain saturated the ground before Helene arrived and continued during the storm's passing. Atmospheric rivers are part of that deadly tragedy as much as the hurricane itself. That is another reason we all need to learn more about them. Meteorologists and media weather reporters are getting on this. They are warning the public. You and I, and everyone we know, need to learn about extreme rainfall events and how our actions or inaction are certain to make these flood events worse and more common. There are limits to how much we can change the atmosphere and survive. Heat is just one limit. The whole water cycle, from the ocean to the ground to all living things, is another big limit, crying for attention. Here is our expert scientist interview. Then I will follow with a quick summary, because this is tricky stuff for we who are not scientists.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists predict the Arctic will get wetter as the planet warms. You've probably heard that. But this is no gentle change. A short burst of heavy rains in a storm over Greenland a few years ago ended up raising global sea levels by 1.2 millimeters. New Science finds extreme water vapor gets to the Arctic in atmospheric rivers. A wetter Arctic changes everything, from ice melt and permafrost thaw through changes to plants and animal life. Qinghua Ding is a climate scientist and associate professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Ding specializes in large-scale prediction of change with a focus on the Arctic and the Antarctic. He co-authored the new paper, Role of Atmospheric Rivers in Shaping Long-Term Arctic Moisture Variability. From California, Qinghua Ding, welcome.
Thank you.
What is an atmospheric river, and how do they get to the Arctic?
The atmospheric river, by its name, you can see that it's like the river in the underground, but it exists, it operates in the atmosphere. So you can think it's just like a plume of the water vapor and propagate or transport in the atmosphere, and mostly above the ground, like the strongest intensity of this phenomenon. Normally we see just like a few hundred meters above the ground and to something like a few like 1,000 meters above ground because of the gravity. And because the gravity of the Earth and the water vapor still try to stay close as possible to the Earth's surface. And we know the air can hold a molecule